This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2019, held at Faith Builders from July 29 through August 2.
Well, good morning, and welcome to this breakout. I trust that you have been encouraged and inspired this week, and I'm sure that my brain is full from all the things we've been taking in, and hopefully you have a little bit room for something else yet. And if not, you can take notes and refer back to them whenever you encounter a challenging student sometime in your teaching career. So I'm a third grade teacher at Shiloh Mennonite School in Lancaster. And I recently completed my bachelor's in special ed. And I just love what I do. I love teaching and it's just such a privilege and an honor. Parents are entrusting their children to us, and we have a lot of responsibility in our role. My first teaching experience was actually in South Dakota, in Cherry Creek, serving under Olive Branch Mission, if you're familiar with that at all. And I taught on the Native American Indian Reservation. And so there, we had a very, very small school, and my students were, the most of them were Native Americans that lived there on the reservation. And I think that my passion and heart really came alive to the reality of broken homes and hurting children through this experience there. And I'll just show you few little pictures here. Up here in the top corner would be some the students that I had in my class 1 year. And this little girl's name is Kiera. I'll just tell you a little bit about her. I would rap on the door of her dilapidated trailer house in the morning before school, often waking her up. She would peek her head out and quickly run back inside, change her clothes and come out, her hair still a crumpled fright. Her mom lay asleep on the couch, recovering from her drunken stupor of the night before, and no one else in her home took it upon themselves to see that she got to school. Several creepy men, her uncles, lived at this house, and I often wondered if she knew abuse. She was very stubborn, and my patience was often tried with her many times, and her attendance issues were so frustrating. Yet my heart went out to her, and I knew that God asked me to love her. Yeah, and I asked him to fill me not only with patience, but with understanding of what was going on underneath. And then there's Jemiah up here, right here on the bottom and also here. He was even more of a challenging student. He would kick and scream sometimes and rip up or wad up his papers into balls, throwing them on the floor, refusing to do his work. He was a big boy, often... he didn't come with the most pleasant smells and of the nature that I really couldn't control him. He spoke of seeing the ghost of his deceased relative in his house, and that same year, his aunt tried to commit suicide. The trip home from school was the best part of the day with him, and we would sing with gusto, "God's not dead, he is alive." And he loved to sing. That was one thing that I really enjoyed pulling out of him. He was a disruption in our classroom, and ended up being expelled from the school eventually. But yet, my heart just longed to love him and to show him Jesus. And I didn't realize it quite until after my experiences working there, just how much it influenced my heart for the struggling students in my classroom. And just recognizing them as whole people, recognizing their emotional, behavioral, spiritual, physical, academic needs, and how that all plays into who they are and how they're learning and what they're learning. So after I moved home from Cherry Creek, I spent 2 years here at Faith Builders, and then I moved to Lancaster to teach there. And I soon learned that hurt and trauma and learning disabilities and broken homes don't evade us there or here. The stories aren't always as horrific or as shocking, maybe, but the pain and the brokenness that some of our students come with is just as real and heartbreaking. And sometimes I actually wonder if maybe it's harder for us to offer grace and love and understanding in a setting where they should have strong homes and there should people should be living moral, upright lives, and children should know better and be able to behave. And so I think wonder sometimes in this kind of a setting that's like expected. And yeah, sometimes I just wonder if it's a little bit more difficult for us sometimes to really understand in our settings. So today, yeah, I want to talk about how to love and work with a student who doesn't mesh into our ideal for our smoothly functioning classroom. Now, there's kind of two parts in this. They might be struggling. You might consider them a challenging student because of their academic needs, or because of their behavioral needs, or because of both. And I'm hoping that this kind of, today we could talk about both sides of that somewhat. Although I am thinking a little more along the lines of behavior. And I want to also recognize that this discussion or topic is going to bring up a lot of complex issues and specific situations that each of you and I know and work with. And I think we need to recognize that every situation is different and every child is different. And so I cannot tell you, I don't know the whole story, and so I cannot tell you what exactly you need to do about it. But my goal is to kind of give us some overarching ideas or principles or ways we can think about what's going on here and how can we help. So, the challenging student. When I think of the challenging student, this is what I'm thinking of. The student whose behavior is constantly pushing the boundaries that you're not sure what to do with. Someone whose academic performance is inconsistent, like they can do it today, tomorrow, or this, they're really struggling, or someone who's just antics grind against your gears that you just can't quite connect with them. And so those are the types of students that I'm thinking about here this morning. And then we think about love for the challenging students. And we know that God is love. It is what he always in every respect is, and it's impossible for him not to love. That's who he is. And he asks us to love our students. And as I allow God's love to fill me and overflow from within, then I'm able to love more, to love the unlovely, to love through difficulty and when working with challenging students. And Jesus tells us about children, and Jesus loves children, all children, and he showed compassion toward the weaker vessel. We see that often in scripture where he is loving the unlovely. Jesus said, "See that you despise not one of these little ones." And that can be a challenge when we have a student in our classroom that we struggle connecting with. We struggle to figure out how to help them. Jesus says, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me." So as we are serving our students, we're serving Jesus in our classrooms. We're being Jesus to them. And we know that every child was created in the image of God. He has created them just as he intended, and God does not make mistakes, and we need to keep that in front of us when we're working with our students. Now, I find that we know these things, and we know in our head what we should do, and sometimes it can be hard to make that practical and carry that out. And so, first I want to think a little bit about our perspective, and the perspective that we're coming to our students with. So, I have a story that I'm going to read here this morning. This is a fictional story, so it is not true, but it is full of truth that about our view of challenging students and our interaction with them. And so, as I read this, I would just like you to think about what part of the story stands out to you or what parts of it connect with your experience. So depending on the experiences that you had, just listen to this and then we'll talk about what stood out to you in it. This is called Teddy Stoddard, and it's by Elizabeth Silence Ballard. There was a story many years ago of an elementary teacher. Her name was Mrs. Thompson. And as she stood in front of her fifth grade class on her very first day of school, she told the children a lie. Like most teachers, she looked at her students and said that she loved them all the same. But that was impossible, because there in the front row, slumped in his seat, was a little boy named Teddy Stoddard. Mrs. Thompson had watched Teddy the year before and noticed that he didn't play well with the other children, that his clothes were messy, and that he constantly needed a bath. And Teddy could be unpleasant. It got to the point where Mrs. Thompson would actually take delight in marking his papers with a broad red pen, making bold X's and then putting a big F at the top of his papers. At the school where Mrs. Thompson taught, she was required to review each child's past records, and she put Teddy's off until last. However, when she reviewed his file, she was in for a surprise. Teddy's first grade teacher wrote, "Teddy is a bright child with a ready laugh. He does his work neatly and has good manners. He is a joy to be around." The second grade teacher wrote, "Teddy is an excellent student, well liked by his classmates, but he is troubled because his mother has a terminal illness and life at home must be a struggle." His third grade teacher wrote, "His mother's death has been hard on him. He tries to do his best, but his father doesn't show much interest, and his home life will soon affect him if some steps aren't taken." Teddy's fourth grade teacher wrote, "Teddy is withdrawn and doesn't show much interest in school. He doesn't have many friends and sometimes sleeps in class." By now, Mrs. Thompson realized the problem, and she was ashamed of herself. She felt even worse when her students brought her Christmas presents, wrapped in beautiful ribbons and bright paper, except for Teddy's. His present was clumsily wrapped in the heavy brown paper that he got from a grocery bag. Mrs. Thompson took pains to open it in the middle of the other presents. Some of the children started to laugh when she found a rhinestone bracelet with some of the stones missing and a bottle that was one quarter full of perfume. But she stifled the children's laughter when she exclaimed how pretty the bracelet was, putting it on and dabbing some of the perfume on her wrist. Teddy Stoddard's day after school that day, just long enough to say, "Mrs. Thompson, today you smelled just like my mom used to." After the children left, she cried for at least an hour. On that very day, she quit teaching reading, writing, and arithmetic. Instead, she began to teach children. Mrs. Thompson paid particular attention to Teddy. As she worked with him, his mind seemed to come alive. The more she encouraged him, the faster he responded. By the end of the year, Teddy had become one of the smartest children in the class. And despite her lie that she would love all the children the same, Teddy became one of her teacher's pets. A year later, she found a note under her door from Teddy, telling her that she was still the best teacher he had ever had in his life. 6 years went by before she got another letter, another note from Teddy. He then wrote that he had finished high school, third in his class, and she was still the best teacher he had ever had in his whole life. 4 years after that, she got another letter saying that while things had been tough at times, he'd stayed in school, had stuck with it, and would soon graduate from college with the highest of honors. Then more years passed, and yet another letter came. This time, he explained that he had gotten his bachelor's degree. He decided to go a little farther. The letter explained that she was still the best and favorite teacher he had ever had. By now, his name was a little longer. The letter was signed Theodore F. Stoddard, M.D., or Doctor. The story doesn't end there. You see, there was yet another letter that spring. Teddy said he'd met this girl and was going to be married. He explained that his father had died a couple of years ago, and he was wondering if Mrs. Thompson might agree to sit in the place at the wedding that was usually reserved for the mother of the groom. Of course, Mrs. Thompson did. And guess what? She wore that bracelet, the one with several rhinestones missing. And she was sure she was wearing the perfume that Teddy remembered his mother wearing on their last Christmas together. They hugged each other, and Dr. Stoddard whispered in Mrs. Thompson's ear, "Thank you, Mrs. Thompson, for believing in me. Thank you so much for making me feel important and showing me that I can make a difference."
Mrs. Thompson, with tears in her eyes, whispered back. She said, Teddy, you have it all wrong. You were the one who taught me that I could make a difference. I didn't know how to teach until I met you.
I just think that that's a powerful story. And I'm going to give you a little time to talk with someone next to you. What's something that stuck out to you about this story or something that connected with your experience? Go ahead. All right. But a few of you be willing to share what's something that stuck out to you about the story.
We noticed how the teacher didn't know the backstory of Teddy. And so she made assumptions about what kind of person he was until she found out the story. And I experienced that when I had a student who was violent on the playground, hitting people. And I just thought he had a big problem, and he did. But years later, I realized I found out his father had been abusive to me, and I had never known that. So there were pieces of a person's story that we don't know.
Thank you. I mean, yeah, go ahead, in the back.
I just find maybe how she learned to love that little person. And I think that's been in my life. Back when I was learning how to love see the child, the little person, it's just as important as me.
Yes. Yeah. I like how she brought out, we teach students, not subjects. And so we do, the curriculum is very important, don't get me wrong, but we need to keep the students in front of us. They are people, like you were saying, and we need to, keep that in front of us. Love this child for who he is and not for what he does. Sometimes it's easy to love the children that do everything we want exactly how we told them to, and these children sometimes need our love even more, and think about who they are. And they each have a story that has shaped them. And sometimes we know very little about their story. And as we are learning to know them, I think of myself as a student of my students. I'm learning to know who are they? What are they thinking? What are they about? Trying to understand their world and the context that they are coming from. And yeah, every child is precious, and we need to reflect that back to them. One thing that I was taught a lot in my courses is that we need to talk about our students with something called person-first terminology, as in, this is if a child has something that they've been diagnosed with or they have a certain problem, to say, this is a child with dyslexia, or this is a child with autism, or that has experienced trauma, or this is a child with Down syndrome, versus saying this is a Down syndrome child, or this is a dyslexic child. But to put the word child first, and just in how we're talking about them, because it shows more respect, and it shows that, again, the whole idea of they are a child, a person, and that comes first. The difficulty that they experience does not define who they are. And I could just throw a little bit about labels, too, as you think about. We're not qualified. You and I are not qualified to diagnose children. And sometimes other people, if they've gotten evaluated by someone or something, they might have a label that goes with them. Labels can be good and bad. Just throw this out there. They can be freeing for a child in the way of, this is why it's so hard for me. This is why learning is so hard. It's actually a reason. It's not just because I'm dumb. Like there's a reason for it. But labels can also be an excuse for a child. Well, I have this problem, so I can't do it, and so I'm not going to try. So there's two sides to that. I always be really careful with how we are talking about our children, how we're... just be careful with labeling them. I think also that it's important to remember that God has given us all different gifts. Every child is different. And if we were all the same, it would not be a very fun world, okay? The child in your classroom, they might never be a writer or an articulate speaker or a detail-oriented engineer, but they might grow up to be a faithful, hands-on servant in the church. And they have strengths that God has given them. And our goal is... say it like this. I think that it's okay that not all of our students are top-notch students in school. We kind of have this set box that we want them all to thrive in, this little box that we call school. And some students are never going to thrive in school. And if we can figure out how to develop them into who God has created them to be and to be okay with that. I've heard preachers talk about how school was awful and it was so hard for them, and they can, like, you can still be successful in life without getting A's in school. Just think we should keep that in front of us as well. So yeah, understand that our students are different, and that is a wonderful thing, actually. I'd like to move on to thinking about growing understanding of the behaviors that we're experiencing in our classrooms. So sometimes, I find that the easiest thing for us to go to whenever we are experiencing a child with negative behavior or behaviors that we don't like is to say they just need to try harder. Or they're just not trying hard enough, they're just having a bad attitude. And sometimes that is the case. Sometimes a student is having attitude problems. But I feel like often these behaviors that we are seeing, there's actually something a lot bigger going on underneath. And so I would encourage us to think of, and by behaviors, I mean things like, even like, so a student that is a show-off, or a student who is very withdrawn and doesn't, is very hesitant to participate, or a student that is angry, and to learn to interpret misbehavior as a cry for help, or they're trying to communicate something. So just this past year, I was working with a student who, at recess time, he would, whenever he... even like if you're playing tag and he bumped into someone, he felt threatened by that, and he like threw himself on the ground and threw a huge fit. And it appeared to me like he didn't have a good reason to be that upset. And so he had these huge, like he would cry a lot, and he would use his voice and get loud about it and just like feel very, and he would say like, they're hurting me or they're after me. Like he would feel threatened by that. And as I started working with him, like we could have punished him and said, punished him for the way he was behaving. But as I worked with him, I began to realize that his behavior was actually trying to communicate something. I started to think about it as a cry for help, as in he's communicating, I'm hurting inside, I don't know how to handle these big feelings, like something was causing a bigger reaction than necessary. And so we started to, instead of punishing him, to actually try to teach him what he should be doing instead, teaching those skills that are missing. And so I sat down with him, and we actually talked about how big is our problem and how should we be responding. So if someone bumps into you and you accidentally fall down, which, like, you're not bleeding, there's no injuries, like to help him think. He needed actually help to think through, like to calm, like to keep himself calm, teach him how to calm down and to look at himself and to be like, I'm actually okay, I'm not bleeding, and to hop up and keep on going. Like, we had actually talked through to help him think through that. And I kind of talked with him also about, like, his body and thinking about how he's starting to feel himself get uptight. And when I sensed him doing that, I would say, come over here and stand beside me until you're calmed down, and then you can go play again. Kind of catch it before it becomes a huge problem. And I think just recognizing that there's something bigger underneath is what I'm really wanting you to hear from me. Now, again, every situation is different. And I think I came to my conclusions because I know the big picture of for this student. And I knew some of his family experiences, some of his other things going on that helped me to come to the conclusion that I did. And so, yeah. I mean, I think of another student from last year as well. I had a challenging group. He, in the year before, was extremely edgy, very, very fidgety, and, like, very off-task. It looked a lot like ADHD, like, or something, like he couldn't focus. And he came to me, and I was just really paying really close attention to this because I knew of some of the struggles that he had. And I tried very hard, like to think about my structure and management and what kind of routines I have in my classroom. And then I also tried to regularly step in and say to, like, in different ways to say, I see you, you're doing a good job, keep going, keep doing it. And we realized that while he was really craving was attention, he was craving for people to see him and he just needed that attention that said that someone sees me here and that I have value and that they recognize that I'm working hard. And when we regularly stepped in and did that, it was incredible that he did not have those problems. Like, he suddenly was... Okay, it wasn't, like, drastic, but we felt a big improvement in his ability to succeed and to be independent in his work. Just with understanding what was going on beneath the behavior. Do you have thoughts or questions on those stories? Or this idea? So when I'm... Okay, I also wanted to point this out as well. As we are thinking about these challenging behaviors and looking underneath and recognizing maybe why this is happening, I also would like to say that a student's emotional needs or the reasons behind their behavior is not an excuse, does not excuse them from the consequences of what they have done. So I feel like we need some balance in that. Is there still right and wrong? And if this child hits someone else, there's still consequences for that. Like, maybe they've experienced trauma or something. That's not excusing them from right and wrong. So I think we need balance in that. So, some questions that I ask sometimes when I'm faced with a challenging behavior or a challenging student is, what happened right before the behavior began? So what set it off? Is there something that, like, was the turning point that really caused this behavior to explode? And sometimes just being a good observer, again, a student of your students, you can figure these things out. And then, what might he be trying to communicate with his behavior? And then, how can I meet his need or teach him the skills that he's lacking so that we can move forward and have improved behavior? So when we're thinking about number two, what might he be trying to communicate? Here are some ideas. So, he might be trying to obtain or get something. Like, he might be wanting attention from peers. He might be wanting attention. Sorry, there's not a separate spot for this. This is kind of bonus. He might be wanting a desired item. He might be needing to stimulate himself. For some reason, he might be trying to get something. And often, I feel like the attention one is common. Or his behavior, he might be trying to avoid something. He might be trying to avoid a request from you. He might be trying to avoid this activity. So if math is really hard, and he always, you get this negative behavior right after math class, right in math, maybe he's trying to, he's behaving this way so that he can, knows that he'll be able to get out of math because he does not want to do math. And so it then, you know, you remove him and you're working with him and he gets to miss, skip something that is difficult. So they might be trying to, yeah, I just think about what are they trying to get or what are they trying to avoid and how can I get to the root of the problem. I also think a little bit about the whole rebellion thing and attitudes. You know, sometimes, especially as students are getting older, they might be facing a spiritual battle or they might be under conviction and they might be, you know, acting differently because of this. Maybe there's nothing underneath the problem, really, and it's just the fact that they need to decide for themselves, are they going to do right or wrong? So it's not like every behavior has this complex meaning behind it. Yeah. I was working with some challenging fifth grade boys in this past year in a different setting. And I had a friend who encouraged me with this. She said, "Your difficult boy students are in a spiritual battle, a time of figuring out who they are. Don't lose heart. Just because things feel bad now, it could be the very moments in their lives that God uses to touch their hearts for eternity and plant seeds that will someday make them useful in kingdom work." And that just really encouraged me that maybe this is more of a spiritual battle, and maybe we just need to stick it out and be faithful and make sure that they know that we hear them and that that we're behind them and supporting them. All right, moving on to connecting and relating to these students. Your child needs a relationship with you. Now, not a, like, lovey-dovey, will you be my friend? I want you to like me kind of relationship. Okay? He needs a relationship built on love and respect, but it also needs to be grounded in routine and stability. He needs to know that you have his back, that he can trust you. And that involves being consistent with your love and with your consequences. So, relationships need to be safe, kind, and nurturing, and then balanced with firm, consistent, authoritative, stable direction, stable as we are working with them. And as we think about students that push our boxes a little bit, I think that we need to think about providing a balance between nurture and structure. So we have lots of nurture. That is making students feel important when they walk into your class. Pouring love and dreams into them, being sensitive to their backgrounds, and looking for their strengths, encouraging them in that. And high nurture is what builds trust. Okay. And if we don't have the nurturing piece, they're going to not hear us. And then high structure is the part that helps them to grow. So as we amp up our structure, we need to also build our nurture. Like, there needs to be a balance there. And both pieces are very important. High nurture builds trust. High structure helps them to grow. And just consistency is a huge, huge thing here. And it's tempting when you have a child that you know has some reasons behind their behavior to feel bad when you have to enforce a consequence. And I think in some ways we need to not get too emotionally entwined, but he did this. Here, this is the consequence that we have agreed upon. And true love, I just feel, is giving the student what he needs, not what feels nice in the moment. And so to be really careful that we are consistent. Children crave structure and consistency. Otherwise, they're confused. True love gives the student what he needs, not what feels nice in the moment. Let's move on to thinking about expectations. You and I have expectations for our classroom this coming year, especially if you've taught already. You've been watching, at least I do, toward the end of the year, is always like looking at the class that's coming. And you know, if you've had these students already, you might know your students quite well that you are going to have next year if you have multiple grades. And I think our expectations can be stated or they can be unstated. Maybe we don't even really know what they are, but we have them. And we will receive what we expect from our students. And so we have expectations, and our students are going to conform to those. And so to have high expectations, if you know that you're getting a student that you're concerned about or that you imagine this might be challenging, I would just pray that you could give them a fresh start, that you could really have an open mind, and that you believe the best in this child. Even if you know that they had trouble last year, it's a new year. Give them a fresh start. And I mean, we have to be careful also to think about making sure our expectations are realistic and precise and feasible for them to meet. But Bruce Wilkinson, in this book, talks about expectations in two chapters in here, and how he thought that he was given the smart class in the school. Like, it was a huge school, as in they had multiple grades in this, multiple classrooms with the same grade, and he thought that he received the class that were the exceptionally smart ones, and they actually turned out that it wasn't after all, but his class did way better than the other one because of his expectations for them. It's just a fascinating story. I didn't quite tell it all to you, but if you would like to read it, it shows how much our expectations change what our students can do or what we get out of them. Expectations empower others when guided by love. And at the top of your sheet is 1 Corinthians 13 there, and it says, love believes all things and hopes all things. Believe in your students. And I just have found how much that has helped, just with positive environment and just with they want to please, and it's amazing how they can rise up to what you expect. So, as we think about our challenging students, what is our approach to discipline, or how are we going to approach this? I just have a few suggestions. And again, it depends a lot on you and your style as a teacher and many different factors. We often have these consequence systems where you know, a student does something and they have to give pennies if they, like, you take a penny if they don't do this, or you give out pennies when they do things, or sometimes I've seen systems with dots or popsicle sticks or those kinds of things. And this is something that I've been thinking about personally, is that I don't just want my students to obey so that they don't get the consequence. I don't want to control my students' behavior by the system that I have going. I actually want them to be developing convictions, or actually like doing it because they know that it's right, versus trying to please me. And when, especially when I began teaching, I felt like when I was confronted with a behavior problem, or a student did something and it was clearly I needed to address the problem, and I pulled them aside to talk to them, I often was like, well, what do I talk about? Or how do I talk about this with them? Rather than saying, so you did this, here's the consequence. Like, how do I talk about them with them that actually will help them to not do it again next time? And I, what I'm going to share with you is from this DVD series by Paul David Tripp about just having a culture of grace in our schools. And he gave 5 questions to help students think through what they've done wrong. And in my first year at Shalom, I had this on a sticky note on my desk to kind of like help prompt me a little bit when I had these kinds of interactions with students. So he goes into depth about this. If this is interesting to you, I would just really recommend these. He's an excellent speaker in thinking about how do we help children actually change. And so the first thing that he tells in here is to ask, what was going on? You want to hear from the child, what, from their perspective, what happened? And then he says to ask them, what were you thinking and feeling as it was happening? This helps the child look at his heart inside of himself rather than blaming, oh, it's their fault, they did it all. And that's probably what come out in number one, what they did. But then, what were you thinking and feeling? Were you feeling frustrated or angry or scared? What was happening inside of you? And then number 3, so what did you do in response? And this is helping him to take ownership of his response and recognizing that his response in number 3 was the result of number 2, like it follows. So something was happening inside of me, and then I did this. Number 4 then is going into motives. So why did you do it? What were you seeking to accomplish? Were you trying to get back at someone else? Were you trying to get your own way here? And then number 5, what was the result? What happened? What are the consequences now since you've done this? I believe that these questions are just really biblical, actually, in helping a child think through and to view himself as the Bible does, is that he has to accept responsibility for what he's done. He grows in starting to understand himself better and recognize the need that he has. Now, these kinds of questions, you're not going to always get good answers from students for them. You might ask them, what were you thinking and feeling? And they'd be like, well, I don't know. And so I feel like these questions are, sometimes we might need to help them answer them. Now, if they're, especially when they're really young, or give them options. Were you feeling this or this or this? And I think just asking these questions is planting the seed to start thinking about our heart and what's going on. Does anybody have any comments or thoughts so far? I would also just like to talk a little tiny bit about corporal punishment or spanking students, and this is a controversial kind of topic. I'm just curious, in here, how many of your schools would spank students for like a major offense? Just curious. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, our depends a lot on your school culture and what your community, what's accepted there. And I'm not saying that you should not do that. I think that it's just important that we're actually getting to the root of the problem. Now, so if it is for sure a rebellion problem, or just it is purely disobedience or whatever the problem is, then, I mean, by all means. But I feel like if you're spanking a child over and over again and it's not fixing the problem, that there's something bigger underneath. So when it's like a repeated behavior, I worked with a student actually who parents were spanking at home very regularly because of reports from school, and it was not making a difference. And the parents recognized that, like, we're doing this and it's not making a difference. And why, like, they were up against a little bit, and why isn't this working? And when that is the case, I think we need to look deeper. Is there something else? Is this child not capable of controlling what they're doing? Or is there, just it's something to think about if it's a repeated thing. And I think we can think too about discipline as discipleship versus punishment, and trying to find the balance there. So some of the challenges that we face when working with students that are challenging, whether it's behavior or whether it's academic, is with the whole relating to parents thing. And I just have a few things to consider here as we are relating to parents. And you've probably heard this many times this week, I hope, about communication. And there's a lot that we can do in how we approach parents, and how we word things can really make a huge difference. And so if we approach it with asking them questions or saying, I've been noticing that your child is doing this at school. Do you see this at home as well? Do you have any insight as to why this might be happening? To form it in a question, like, I want input from you, versus saying, your child is doing this and we're doing this, like, this needs to change. That's very, it's very confrontational. And so to try to think about asking questions. I ask a lot of questions of parents. And it's amazing how many times they're like, yeah, like, we see the same thing too. And then I can give my opinions a little bit more. I think about the sandwich approach, which was taught to me that when you're communicating with parents, start with positive and end with positive. There are things that you need to say. You need to be honest, and you need to say the truth, what really is happening. But to start and end with positive, and it really, that also helps in communication. I think we also have to recognize our role as teachers, in that we are servants, or we are supporting parents, and the child is ultimately their responsibility. And I think there's something about believing in parents and recognizing that every parent is doing the best that they know for their child. It might not be what we think would be the best, but I feel some pushback over here. Can you talk to me about it?
I have worked in a situation in the past year where that was definitely not the case. Mm-hmm. It was a really unusual situation.
Mm-hmm.
But the parents, the boy was in our school, but there wasn't parental, even interaction almost. Like, they weren't doing the best that they know because they were completely absent from the school's life.
Mm-hmm. Did they know that they were not doing a good job? Like, if... Yeah. It's hard. other thoughts on this? Are they choosing that I am not going to be involved because I don't think it's... Are they choosing to not be involved because... Like, do they not know better?
In my case, I believe that they chose not to because it was too overwhelming for them.
Mm-hmm.
They knew there was a problem, but they chose to not accept it.
Mm-hmm.
They never had the rest of the children that they had at the school, never had issues that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it was like hard for them to accept that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so things that were sent to the parents never happen that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I think those are some specific, very challenging situations. Yeah. Any other thoughts on that? Or go ahead.
I have situations I'm talking about. I didn't think it all that, but I also have a student in my class that comes to school with very low energy, very low effort. It's not like he's a mean, terrible student, but missed the degree kind of throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I dealt with it all last year. I tried to anyway. And by the end, I wasn't too, towards the end of the year, all of a sudden I realized, man, I haven't gained anything. And I was having a couple of conversations with the parents with the year. And they were like, yeah, I have to deal with the same thing at home.
Mm-hmm.
And got spanking at home a couple times, and it improved a little bit, but that didn't fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just came to realize that throughout the year that it's not the child's fault. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's the parents not realizing at home they're not living a necessarily ungodly life, but they're also not living a good family life.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, this little boy just needs a life.
Mm-hmm.
And so it mm-hmm. goes very much with what you're teaching here, and I appreciate that. It's we can relate to the parents, but then it also comes to a point where you can't even talk to the parents in a way of, you know, it means parents need counseling, not the boy.
Mm-hmm.
But the boy needs the love at school, and that make the school a safe place for him or her and the time that you have him there. And that's towards the end of the year, that's where I changed my style or changed a couple things up, and I know by the end of the year I have. When he came to school, that's where he would switch to happiness again because now he was ready to be safe. So
that's really sad, but
it's hard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is, I guess, where you bring up a lot of stories and experiences and complex things. I think the majority of the time we can believe in parents. That's been my experience. And then there's these cases along the way that, because I think as teachers, we shouldn't, in the majority of cases, we should make sure that we are supporting parents and not giving them the idea that we don't agree with them unless it's a specific, really difficult case. Anyway. In this whole thing, I would think about trying just to understand the parents' perspective a little bit, in the understanding the journey that they are on So there is kind of a grieving process when you realize that your child is not a perfect angel like you thought, or when school is actually hard and you didn't know that. Like, they're actually, it takes time for, like, I'm not a parent, but as I've interacted with parents, it just, we need to offer grace sometimes in that way and keep putting a plug in. But it is a difficult thing for parents to accept that sometimes. Not sometimes, they totally see it as well at home. But yeah, I think we should just be careful in how hard we are on parents sometimes. Again, that's coming from my perspective, which I recognize is different than yours. So, we have 2 minutes, and I would just like to flip to the back of your handout. And I realize this is kind of a heavy topic in some ways, and so, yeah, I guess it's my prayer that we can look at our students with understanding and with love, and I often pray that God will give me insight into my students and just an ability to look past surface behaviors, an ability to know when grace is due and when consequences are due. And our challenging students are the ones that need us the most. And so I just pray that each of you can step into your classroom with love, and that you can empower your students as you connect and relate with them. I guess I'm not going to take time to read over this First Corinthians 13 with teachers, but read that or post it somewhere, and that I hope it can be an encouragement to you. Any last-minute thoughts or questions before we dismiss? Go ahead.
Last year was a special challenge to him. He had a lot of trouble with catching the girls. That was his love. Mm-hmm. He was loving to be killed by physical touch. Mm-hmm. But he was around gender loving. And he was way too busy and things like that. Yeah. He had a lot of trouble with it. Can we talk to the parents about it?
Yeah. And see, in that kind of situation, I also think about how can we give him that in an appropriate way. So I realized as a lady teacher, I mean, but if you have a man teacher that like would greet him with a hug every morning, or like, or a principal or someone, like, to try to, how can we meet that need in a way that's more appropriate? Which is something else I would think about.
I give my students the option every morning as they walk. I greet them at the door, and every one of them I ask hug, handshake, or high five. But they're first graders, so it's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, depending a lot on your the age level makes a difference there too. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you for your time and attention. I hope you have a great rest of your day.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.